Welcome back to Evolution of a Snake. I'm Zach.
And I'm Madeline.
And today we are doing something fun, something iconic, something hilarious. We are going to be walking you through and ranking the 10 most consequential, memorable, iconic feuds in the Taylor Swift history.
I think we're always doing something fun on Evolution of a Snake, if I may say.
You know what? You're right, and you should say it.
And I actually should say it.
Well, that reminds me, there is something really fun that we're doing. It's called the Snares Tour, evolutionofasnake.com for tickets. DC, you sold out. So what did we do? We released our comp tickets for you. That's right. We get comp tickets for every venue and you can have ours. So go get them. LA, you're sold out. Can't get them. New York, eyes on you. It's almost over. It's almost curtains for anybody that wants to come see us in New York. So hurry up. Boston, DC, Atlanta, Nashville, San Francisco, Seattle. Girls, Madison, Wisconsin. How could I forget Madison, Wisconsin? Can't forget Madison.
We can't. It's not possible. Madison, Wisconsin.
So, evolutionofsnake.com for tickets. You know what the hell it is. And Madeline, why don't we just get straight into it? Who do you have at number 10 on this list?
So the number 10 iconic, classic, memorable Taylor Swift feud is who else other than Demi Lovato. Now, this is an iconic feud because it is one of the few one-sided feuds that Taylor has underneath her belt. In fact, I think it might be the only tried and true, longest-running one-sided feud in that Demi Lovato was feuding with Taylor, but Taylor has never been feuding with Demi Lovato, okay? Let's get that straight from the jump. At no point in time has Taylor ever said anything bad about Demi Lovato. However, Demi cannot say the same. Demi has said many, many unkind things about Taylor. And it kept, it's like whack-a-mole. It just keeps coming back up. It just keeps coming back up. So it all technically actually begins with Selena Gomez. It's crazy to me that this happened so long ago that there are people walking around on this earth right now alive watching this who don't know that Selena Gomez and Demi Lovato used to be BFF. I'm not talking about like, oh, they were friends.
More than Taylor and Selena.
They did everything together. They made vlogs together. The Princess Protection Program, Triple P. Some people were streaming it. I was. I've watched it. I've seen it like 3 times. It's a really good movie.
Great
movie.
If you
haven't seen it. Great movie. Cinema, ladies and gentlemen. But they were best friends. And the story goes, I mean, there's the Demi Lovato and Selena Gomez friendship is a, you could do a whole separate video on just that. And it's super interesting. And there's a lot to get into. But a lot of people think that the breakdown of Demi Lovato and Selena Gomez's friendship began when Selena and Taylor started getting very close to one another. Because Taylor started like ingratiating herself with the Disney crowd. There's actually a picture of her with Demi Lovato and Miley Cyrus and Emily Osment.
Best picture of all time.
It is. And actually, Miley posted that for International Women's Day in 2019. Did
Correct.
You know that?
And she's it right, was and she should say it.
Amazing. And I said, exactly. But nonetheless, Taylor and Demi were friendly, and Taylor was friendly with all those Disney people, including, might I remind you, the Jonas Brothers, at least for one
a
summer.
A little bit.
And for one summer, you were mine. And for one summer, you were mine. But nonetheless, she started getting particularly close to Selena. And the next thing you know, this was kind of like this was Franz Ferdinand getting shot. This was what started, this is what started World War I. So Demi Lovato is signing autographs, okay? And there's a video of her doing this. And she's signing autographs. And a fan asks, how's Selena? Because, oh, Demi Lovato and Selena Gomez are best friends, correct? And Demi doesn't miss a beat. It was crazy for me to rewatch this video. I hadn't seen it in years. And literally, she doesn't miss a beat. She doesn't reflect upon it. She doesn't think. She just looks right into the camera, smiles, and goes, ask Taylor. And then goes right back to signing. The hatred.
the
venom.
Evil that popped out of her in that time.
The evil that popped out of her at that time. This was a big deal. There was nobody who cared about any of these three people who didn't know about Ask Taylor. It's still talked about today. Ask Taylor, it was the No, That's Becky of 2010, literally.
It was everything to me, and the fact that we have a video of it is hilarious.
It's everything to me.
And also, I feel like Demi Lovato, I mean, she was going through it at the time. She was really going through it, but, you know, being an agent of chaos and commenting on things unprovoked is a theme of Demi Lovato's life, and specifically in her feud with Taylor.
Exactly. And Taylor never said a word about Ask Taylor. And yet, the hits kept on coming as the years went on. Now, this was a surprising little nugget I found just when I was doing a little bit of research. Oddly, in 2012, I found a random tweet from Demi Lovato's Twitter where she quotes, "And I'll look back and regret how I ignored when they said, 'Run as fast as you can,' from Dear John." And I found that really interesting because I could certainly see her relating deeply to that song. And
well, at the beginning of their kind of feud, I suppose, the anger was really more towards Selena than it was towards Taylor. She was definitely taking more shots at Selena than Taylor.
Taylor was just getting it, you know, and this is a one-sided feud. It's not like Demi had anything concrete to actually be mad at Taylor about, because Taylor never said or did anything. So fast forward to 2016. Demi criticized everyone's favorite topic to criticize at the time, the girl squad. And she said that the bodies of the women in the squad were not realistic. She said, "This will probably get me in trouble, but I don't see anybody in any sort of squad that has a normal body. It's kind of this false image of what people should look like." She also said that, "I think having a song and video about tearing Katy Perry down, that's not women's empowerment." Some people might say points were made.
Unfortunately, she cooked. The comments that Demi was making about Taylor, again, like, weren't wrong. They were coming from a place of truth. But as with Demi, always, the execution is the issue. And it's like, Demi, it's not as though you are Martin Luther King out here in these streets. She's telling Taylor to take it to Capitol Hill. But where's Demi?
Exactly. And that's the real coup of 2016. She didn't stop at Bad Blood. She didn't stop at attacking the girl squad. So what happened was Taylor donated $250,000 to Kesha's legal fund. This was just at the start of Kesha's legal battle with Dr. Luke. That's $250,000. That's a lot of money. And that was a huge deal to Kesha, I'm sure. But Demi was not impressed by this. Not in the least
bit.
She
specifically said that was bad and not enough. And it's like, Demi, you don't have $250,000 to give to your mother. So let's rein it in.
But she said, "Take something to Capitol Hill or actually speak out about something, and then I'll be impressed."
Okay. One of my favorite pop culture moments ever of all time. It's just so funny. I mean, it's a meme that we use to this day.
Take it to Capitol Hill like it's Bruiser's Bell. Take it like you're Legally Blonde and go to Capitol Hill with your Bruiser's Bell. Exactly. And again, to reiterate the point from before, points are being made, and yet at the same time, they're not being made at all, because you're doing buffoonery and you're doing it on the world stage.
And that is Demi's plight. Like, most of her issues in public, she is usually making a good point, but she does something that, like, completely contradicts or counteracts the goodness of that point. And that's why we have to stand.
Exactly. This is why it's one of my favorite one-sided feuds, not just Taylor feud, but favorite one-sided feud of all time. But this comment, these series of comments really set the scene for 2019 and the future issues with Scooter Braun, who, by the way, at the time all of this stuff was coming out with Taylor and Scooter Braun, Demi had literally just signed with him 2 months earlier. I didn't know that. I just discovered that today. 2 months. It's only been 2 months, and Demi is walking up to the bat and swinging for Scooter Braun.
Even Ariana was not saying, "I love Scooter Braun" at this point, you know, and she had been there for a long time, Demi.
So Demi said, "I have dealt with bad people in the industry, and Scooter is not one of them. He's a good man. Personally, I'm grateful he came into my life when he did. Please stop dragging people or bullying them. There's enough hate in this world as it is. Y'all can come after me all you want, but I'm always going to stay loyal to my team. I value loyalty more than most people in this world." That's what she had to say for herself.
Well, let me ask you this, Demi. Let me ask you this. How did The Art of Starting Over and Dancing with the Devil do? How did that go? How's your career looking after Scooter Braun started managing you? It's a good question.
And I think we should be asking it. And we did ask it. And Demi apparently knew that, because eventually down the line, we're not talking about Scooter Braun's a good man anymore. Now are we? What's interesting is that Todrick Hall was also involved in this issue. Because he, after Taylor said all the stuff about Scooter and, like, posted her note and this, that, and the other thing, Todrick showed up and he accused Scooter Braun, whom he had previously been signed to, but no longer was at this point, of being homophobic. And Demi Lovato showed up apropos of nothing on his Instagram post randomly, where he's saying, I know Scooter sucks because he's homophobic. And she says, quote, as a member of the LGBTQ plus community myself, he wouldn't have signed me if he was. Okay. Taylor continues to say absolutely nothing. And then, just mere months after all of this drama, Demi posts a screenshot of herself listening to Cruel Summer and said, quote, life is too short for women not to support other women, especially when women release great music. Great job, Taylor Swift. Exactly.
Cruel Summer was the thing that nobody in this world could deny. And Demi was literally like addicted to this conflict going back and forth. She was apologizing, but Taylor didn't care. Wasn't listening, didn't ask.
Didn't say a single word. And all of this just continued to be absolutely nothing, all made up in Demi's head until the VMAs in 2023. This is the official end of the one-sided feud between Demi and Taylor, because Taylor was dancing and singing to Demi Lovato's performance, and Demi actually thanked her for that. And she even said that she was so nervous to go on stage and perform, but when she looked out and saw Taylor dancing and singing, it gave her confidence.
You see how Taylor Swift heals the world and makes it a better place. You see how that works. That is her mission. That is her mantra. That's that pretty girl mantra. And you know what? This was an iconic feud because it was funny and because it shows that Taylor breathes and people have issues with her.
Exactly. The one-sided beef. This is a generational, a once-in-a-lifetime one-sided beef. And I'm saying, I'm sad it's over. I want Demi
Bring
to get back on Instagram. Bring it
Bring
back.
Bring it back, say, Demi, please.
Take another shot.
She's not been messy enough. Like, we need a return to form. No.
And that is why it is the number 10 most iconic Taylor Swift feud of all time. Thank you.
Coming in at number 9 most consequential Taylor Swift feuds of all time, we have Damon Albarn. Who is he? Great question. He is part of the more insufferable Good Music community, part of the bands Blur and the Gorillaz. He has long been known for having very strong opinions on the music industry. He is a rock purist, like another man on this list who we will get to, which means that he values traditional songwriting, instrumentation, and the ever nebulous authenticity in music. Okay. There are many things you can critique Taylor Swift for not being authentic. I'm sorry, divas.
Not one of them.
He has criticized the ever formulaic nature of pop music. He's pointed out that Ed Sheeran and others write factory farm pop. Now that's true. Now that pod person Ed Sheeran.
If you want to talk about pod person Ed Sheeran, I'll let you do it.
A broken clock is right twice a day. However, he has a particular penchant for criticizing, more brutally, female artists. He said that Little Mix wasn't a real band because they don't play instruments. You get up on stage and you do that touch choreography. I want to see you shaking your ass on the floor, Damon.
I want to see it. No, because when you do the Gorillaz videos, you have your little cartoons do it for you, don't you? Don't you?
You write wasabi. I'd like to hear it. I'd like to hear it. He said, and this is actually the most egregious thing, he said Adele was insecure and middle of the road. And I was like, oh, that's something he just said
insecure.
In an interview, par for the course. He said that after they had worked together. They had done sessions and he retroactively went back and spoke to the press and said that she was middle of the road and insecure. Imagine
Adele?
The disrespect to collaborate with someone and get paid to do so and go on to call them insecure. Adele said it was one of the most hurtful things anyone has ever said about her.
He's not going to heaven.
That's also just like, you know, you're all about being a real artist. Well, part of being a real artist is like respecting other artists. You've been invited into someone's space to create with them. You said yes, and you come out and you call them insecure. He should die.
That wasn't right. It wasn't right.
But, you know, he finally took his shot at Taylor Swift. And here's exactly what he said in an interview with the LA Times in 2022 that attracted her ire. So the format of the interview, this is important to know, it's question, answer. It's not like a profile where he's speaking and being quoted and like paraphrased. These are his direct quotes in response to questions. It's like the question's in bold, his answer is underneath. She may not be to your taste, the interviewer says, but Taylor Swift is an excellent songwriter. He says, she doesn't write her songs. And then the interviewer pushes back and says, of course she does. She co-writes some of them. And then he says, that doesn't count. I know what co-writing is. Co-writing is very different to writing. I'm not hating on anybody. I'm just saying there's a big difference between a songwriter and a songwriter who co-writes. Doesn't mean that the outcome can't be really great. And some of the greatest singers, I mean, Ella Fitzgerald, never wrote a song in her life. When I sing, I have to close my eyes and just be in there. Who asked? I suppose I'm a traditionalist in that sense. A really interesting songwriter is Billie Eilish and her brother. I'm more attracted to that than Taylor Swift. It's just darker, less endlessly upbeat, way more minor and odd. I think she's exceptional. This made me feral with madness when I read the full quote, because I had forgotten the lengths to which, and you know what, the amount of factual inaccuracies in this statement, he's literally just some guy. What do you know about writing pop music? You can't do it. You've never done it. You've never had a hit. It's always the hitless wonders spouting off about how easy it is to write pop music. And also, it's hilarious to me that Billie Eilish gets credibility here as a songwriter due to her proximity to her brother. Okay, misogynist, if you respect the man that helps the woman, then all of a sudden the woman is a genius. That is somehow more pure to Damon Albarn, Billie writing with her brother, than Taylor co-writing with someone like Jack Antonoff or Liz Rose. Not even to mention she has overwhelmingly written alone many times with no co-writers. Don't speak on the queen without getting your facts straight.
He literally just opened his mouth and started saying stuff. What does he know about Ella Fitzgerald?
What does he know about singing? I got to close my eyes and sing? Yeah, because that's real effortful for you. You have to channel everything in your being to try and sing. Now, come on now.
I'm silent. I forgot how bad it was.
It was honestly, I completely am 100% with Taylor on this one.
No, she was right.
Taylor lashed out on Twitter saying, I write all of my own songs. Your hot take is completely false and so damaging. He dropped his act so quickly. And he said, I apologize unreservedly and unconditionally. The last thing I would want to do is discredit your songwriting. I hope you understand. What do you mean that's the last thing you'd want to do? You said. She doesn't write her own songs and she's not good. And he also, classic, blamed the journalist for taking it out of context. But the gag is the conversation was printed verbatim in Q&A format. You're an idiot.
He is a complete toolbox. Not just a toolbox, ladies and gentlemen. He got scared. He got really scared.
And I bet the interviewer has, you know, a recorded copy of that conversation. So he should really walk that back.
I bet they thought it was so funny when they were sitting there hearing it. Like, now this is common knowledge that Taylor Swift is a
songwriter. Even the interviewer was like, well, yeah, that's not true. And he was like, yes, it is. I made it up. So he really hit the wrong button. He hit the wrong button at the wrong time. This was when she was gearing up to release Midnights, right after coming off of some of her best and most prolific singer-songwriter work of all time with Folklore and Evermore. The re-recordings had just happened. All Too Well 10. I mean, the myth and the fable of All Too Well 10 is that it's all about her writing. That's the story. So, you know, it was Tay optimism in a way that I would like to see again. So this was a really bad time for Damon Albarn to be spouting off unnecessarily about Taylor Swift. And he regretted it. This is like the one and only time he issued a full retraction to something that he said. But this false and damaging assertion has followed Taylor baselessly throughout her career because she is a woman. It's always a woman who gets accused of being an industry plant or someone who's secretly having people ghostwrite her songs. Mm-hmm. It's never the men. The men are the geniuses. So her credibility as a songwriter is of utmost importance to her. It's her thing that she has. She's not a singer. She's not a dancer. She is a writer. This feud was, I think, very emblematic of how there are certain buttons you just can't press with Taylor Swift. And also, I think it's very characteristic of how direct she has become about people questioning her artistry. Instead of feeling now that she needs to write a whole album to prove herself, she knows that she's got the goods to back it up. So she just admonishes and sends her fans upon him. But something I was thinking about is, you know, a hero is nothing without a villain. And having a persistent criticism to push up against is really good for the brand and it's good for the story. We'll talk more about the necessity of a villain when we get further up this list to a little man called Bob Lefsetz and into. But I personally think when I was going through this, there are like three main ways that Taylor navigates conflict: as the businesswoman, as the underdog, and as the narrator. And I'll explain what they are as we go through. But Madeline, doesn't this remind you of like the good girl shtick as well? Like Taylor has always had to have like an opposing force to kind of push up against and shore up her brand.
Well, yes. Since the dawn of time. And you know what? That's where the victim complex thing comes from.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly where it comes from. And, well, I mean,
it's deserved. In moments like this, I'm like, girl, here she's the underdog. She's lashing out and saying, you know what? You know what? You underestimate me time again. And it's just, it's ludicrous in 2022 to question Taylor Swift's songwriting abilities. Like, you electric chair.
That's just like tomfoolery. And I'm sure like even his friends were like, dude, that's not reality.
You can say you don't like the writing. That's fair to say. Like, if you think it's bad writing, by all means. But you can't say she didn't do it. That is really the issue.
Yeah. And it's like, it's just insane.
It's demonstrably false. It's false. All right. Who's up next, Madeline?
All right. Up next on the list is a girly everybody knows, everybody remembers. Well,
nobody knows and nobody remembers.
Her name is the Scarlet A, Camilla Bell. She was a kind of C actress at the time, even as all this was going on. And now she's not even a Z actress. And you could perhaps say that that's the Te Voodoo at play. Not that she was ever a fantastic actress to begin with. I think that she and she alone shot her career in the face because she was not very good, ladies and gentlemen. However, she was a beautiful girl. And I think we should talk about it.
She was better known for the things that she did on the mattress, and Taylor wanted to talk about that.
At the time that Taylor and Joe were dating, the Jonas Brothers filmed the video for their song Love Bug. Hated the song. Absolutely hated the song. I remember it. I can still hear it in my head. It's like the song that would play as I'm being lowered into the mouth of hell. But Camilla Bell starred as the love interest in that music video, and that is how Joe and Camilla met. I guess you could say that sparks flew, because the next thing you know, Joe is, I guess, falling in love with Camilla Bell. And keep in mind, at this time, Taylor and Joe Jonas were together in a relationship. How could you forget? So a tidbit that I had forgotten about, and I rewatched the Ellen DeGeneres interview, so I heard what she said verbatim, but Taylor already seemed to kind of know that things were not on the up and up. And she said that when she got that last minute recording session in for Forever and Always, it wasn't when they were actually broken up. She described it as when things were starting to go like that. That's when she actually recorded Forever and Always. So it wasn't like she was completely and totally blindsided by the breakup, but she was confused, I think, by it. And clearly she knew that something was going on, but she didn't know quite what. When Taylor found out that the couple went public, she told OK Magazine, I love this tidbit, she told OK Magazine, quote, they've been together for months, and that's why we broke up.
So and she in let her them mind, quote yeah, her. She let them quote she said, Taylor quote, Swift.
I want this plastered on every billboard as far as Kentucky. So in her mind, I think she was really thinking that she had been cheated on and that there was overlap. And I mean, that's just kind of like, when you put two and two together in your head, that's exactly what I would think as well. So then she goes on the Ellen DeGeneres show and slams his ass on national television. She says, we're not together anymore. And I wrote a song about him called Forever and Always. And quote, I'm not even going to remember the boy who broke up with me in a phone call in 27 seconds. And to say that the audience was gagged would be an understatement. And I think we need to get back to this kind of attitude.
Iconic moments in the Taylor Swift canon.
It was cuntitude at a degree that I had never seen before in my young life at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I had never seen anything like it. It was everything to me. So then, immediately following this appearance on Ellen, Joe Jonas took to MySpace, as one did in those days, and he wrote a blog post on MySpace, and he said, let me be clear. To quote Taylor, let me be clear. I have never cheated on any girlfriend, and no one believed him. He has maintained over the years that there was no overlap. But in my mind, the way that I think of it, and of course everybody's different, but like emotional overlap still kind of counts.
Because if you're talking to someone while you're with someone else, and then you're still a traitor,
Olivia Rodrigo,
together with that person you were talking to, then yeah,
exactly, yeah, you're still a traitor. So the songwriting feud kind of started between Joe and Taylor. Taylor did Forever and Always, and then the Jonas Brothers then did a song called Much Better, which was a terrible song. But in it, he says, get a rep for breaking hearts. Now I'm done with superstars and all the tears on her guitar.
That's what
you think. He even says she's much better. That's kind of like the whole thing about the song. She's much better than the country star with tears on her guitar, et cetera, et cetera. Right. So in the midst of all this, to Camilla Bell's credit, she never says anything, nothing, not
the poor
a word.
Diva.
She
the
was biding
poor
her
diva.
Time. She was biding her time. So then Better Than Revenge happens. And maybe Camilla Bell honestly deserves the Purple Medal of Honor for managing to stay quiet during this.
Seriously.
If some girl I never met wrote this song about me because Joe Jonas wasn't in love with her and I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, I would turn into the Joker, especially because at that point, they had been broken up for like a year by the time Better Than Revenge came out.
Well, let's also say that, you know, this is a classic thing you do before you have your feminist awakening. You forget that it's all the guy's fault and it has nothing to do with the girls and no one can be stolen because your men shouldn't be available to be taken. So, I mean, the lyrics in this song, she took him faster than you could say sabotage. Taylor clearly thinks that it's all Camilla Bell's fault and that she would have had him otherwise. But the scariest part of the song to me and the best part, like vocally, everything is at the end when she goes, show me how much better you are. That is enough. If I was Camilla Bell, I would have gone into witness protection.
Well, what's interesting to me about it is I remember she describes Better Than Revenge as being a song about a girl who stole my boyfriend and she thought I would forget and I didn't. The secret message for the song is also, you thought I would forget. This is the work of the Zodiac Killer. Like, this is really, in hindsight, this entire thing makes her look psychotic. At the time, yeah. I was clapping and cheering.
Do you remember the iconic video? She's in Central Park. She's sitting there playing Back to December on the piano, which completely unrelated to anything else going on. It's supposed to be a demure moment. And someone from the crowd screams, I love Better Than Revenge. And she immediately turns to them, narrows her gaze, tilts her chin down and goes, thank you.
She's evil. It was probably the most evil moment that she has ever had. She was deeply proud of this full frontal assault on her fellow woman. She was very
proud of it. She made it a moment on tour, too. She was using Caitlyn and Liz as...
She was slapping them.
She was slapping them.
This is not a game.
It's so crazy.
It's
bad. Feminism off, off, off.
But I will say this, Camilla Bell knows one thing, and that is that revenge is a dish best served cold. She bided her time. She said, I know she's a fool, and my time will come. And well, it did. 2016 came rolling right around.
I'm sure she was chomping at the bit.
Nicki Minaj makes comments about the Video of the Year award at the VMAs in 2016. Taylor is nominated, Nicki is not. Nicki makes a comment about how award shows tend to award people who look a certain way and they don't always acknowledge people who look another way. Taylor reads this as Nicki saying that Taylor is only getting nominated because she's thin, which in hindsight, considering the amount of flack she was taking for the Girl Squad and how the body image thing was such a prevalent conversation, maybe it sort of makes sense why she was so primed to pounce on this and read it that way, especially as a white woman who is confused when we are not about me, to put it one way. Yes. Plus, she had VMA drama to begin with, but nonetheless, she tweets, I've done nothing but love and support you.
Girl.
It's unlike you to pit women against each other. Maybe one of the men took your slot. The rest of this is kind of irrelevant for this particular conversation, and we'll talk about it later when we talk about Nicki. But Katy Perry, immediately after this is tweeted, Katy Perry decides she needs to chime in. She says, I need to speak. She's been dragged through the mud the entirety of this 1989 era. She had an evil hex placed upon her that she cannot seem to shake as this whole thing is blowing up in front of Taylor's face. As Taylor has humiliated herself and put her foot in her mouth on the world stage, Katy decides now's the time. She says, quote, finding it ironic to parade the pit women against other women argument about as one unmeasurably capitalizes on the takedown of a woman. Now that is not in the English that we understand. It isn't. We can understand it because we know what she's trying to say.
But I get it.
It's absolute utter nonsense. And who else decides to hop right on this train? Her name is Camilla Bell. She said, quote, couldn't agree more, dot, dot. And the ellipsis is so sinister to me. She's been waiting. She has literally.
And she deserves.
Waiting.
She deserves to come in and throw her tomato. She deserves to come in and throw her tomato.
I wasn't even upset about this. I thought it was so funny. I was like, oh, they're going to get you.
Yeah. Well, and nothing it was the heel turn because she hadn't really apologized for Better Than Revenge yet. And she wasn't.
No, she never will.
She never said sorry for Better Than Revenge. She just said that it was a period of time before she was awoken to feminism. There was no like, I'm sorry to the woman that I wrote the song about. No.
And the thing is that like there was nothing will bring like women together more than like another woman who they feel has been bullying
A mean
them.
Girl.
A mean girl. It's like we have to get her. What do you think Mean Girls is about? What do you think Mean Girls is about?
And you know what? I have to say, at this moment, she deserved it. She deserved to have Katy Perry and Camila Bell point out that her feminism was shallow, because it was.
Well, I said, Camila, you've earned this one. Take it away.
Take it away.
She literally waited until Taylor was down in the dirt to kick her, and I'm sure it felt really good. She laughed on the schoolyard as soon as Taylor tripped up and hit the ground. But
as
nonetheless,
she should, Queen.
Camila never said anything further. Taylor never said another thing about Camila Bell beyond just changing the lyrics of Better Than Revenge, which ultimately did nothing. So there you have it.
There it is. Number eight. Well, number seven, it's not funny anymore. This isn't a joke. It's my life. Iconic Taylor Swift feuds or consequential Taylor Swift feuds. Number seven is God, Livia, God, Rico, okay? As the Rodrigologist and the Swiftologist, it pains me to acknowledge that there is tension here. But anyone who says that there isn't is really delusional for one reason or another. This one makes me sad. It's not necessarily a feud per se, but anybody with reasonable like eyes and ears can identify this as a strained relationship. If you don't want to say they're having a feud, fine, but there is a strain on this relationship. It's pretty emblematic of her later feuds in the public eye, because this strained relationship seems to have been sparked by, you know how I said there were different ways that Taylor navigates conflict? The businesswoman. She kind of low-key addresses this in Who's Afraid of Little Old Me? I'll sue you if you step on my lawn. Well, Olivia did step on her lawn, and I believe she was metaphorically and maybe literally sued. This interaction shows us that Taylor is, at the end of the day, a businesswoman who will protect her interests at all costs, you know? And I actually think that we are seeing this with Blake Lively at this very moment. It doesn't matter how good of a friend you are. If you threaten the brand will protect itself. If you're not her boyfriend, you are not immune from being thrown under the bus to protect her brand. Her mother and her father probably also fall into that category of protected interests. But that's it. That's it. The Olivia saga is a tale of how Taylor can be both a mentor in the industry as well as a shark, and in some people's perspective, a bully. So here's what happened. When Olivia Rodrigo released Sour in 2021, many compared her music to Taylor Swift's earlier work. Olivia openly cited Taylor as one of her biggest inspirations, and she even, with permission, interpolated New Year's Day in her song One Step Forward, Three Steps Back. Two terrible songs coming together to do a joint slay. Taylor was initially very supportive of Olivia on Instagram when it came out. She said, "That's my baby and I'm real proud" when Driver's License went number one. She was happy to have Olivia and her friend Conan Gray help promote Fearless Taylor's version. Then Deja Vu starts to pop off, and it's like a proof that, you know, Driver's License isn't a fluke, and then she gets another number one hit. And people are starting to suggest that Cruel Summer and Deja Vu share some sort of DNA. And I think Olivia acknowledges this in an interview. She said, "Oh yeah, like that shouty, chanty kind of thing, like I really liked that." She didn't say directly that inspired Deja Vu, but she did acknowledge the comparison. And, you know, I think Olivia's mistake here was viewing Taylor as a mentor only, rightly so, as a young girl and a fan, and not as her competitor. Because make no mistake, Taylor views it the opposite way and probably always has since Driver's License was released. She is the heir. Taylor at this point was not ready to surrender her crown. Like, she knew the Eras was on its way. So essentially what she did is defensive trademarking. And this is not always direct plagiarism. It's more so like an insurance policy to show other artists and people in the industry that if you want to use Taylor's music as an influence and openly credit her for it, the checks need to follow accordingly. So we know this wasn't a situation where Olivia and Dan Nigro, the original writers of the song, decided they were just going to give away 50% of the publishing royalties, which is what happened, I think, with Misery Business and Paramore. Dan Nigro definitely said directly, "It wasn't something that I agreed with. It kind of just happened." He also made vague comments about people wanting a piece of the pie after something blows up, fair comments. Olivia has stayed mute about this, not only about this, but about Taylor in general. And, you can see the strain because she goes from being number one Swiftie, talking about her all the time with joy. She's getting the red ring. She's so excited, to not attending the Eras tour, which is a pinnacle of any Swiftie experience. Also, every celebrity in the world attended. And she never speaks to her again. Conan Gray, also silent too. She mentioned in the Guts promo cycle that she learned a lot about how litigious the industry is and how she won't be that naive about it ever again. And you know what? I think, like, it's all well and good for Taylor to move on and lip sync the words to Vampire at the Grammys, but really there is a power imbalance here that gets overlooked by people who can't compute the idea that Taylor is an aggressive businesswoman and not the world's big sister. Olivia's on her debut album. She's got a lot of press. She's got a lot of industry goodwill. But who has years upon years of connection and influence and can make all of that seem like a flash in the pan if she doesn't get her way? I think, personally, the labels intervened and told Dan and Olivia, this is what's going to happen. It's coming from Taylor's team. You don't have the leverage to disagree, so it's better to just roll over and take it. And that doesn't feel good. So that is my summary of this feud and what it means.
It means a very dark thing, I'll tell you that for free. It's not my favorite chapter in the Swiftie book. I don't like to read the chapter. I don't like to revisit the chapter. I pretend the chapter doesn't exist, and I go on with my merry life in delusion. That's what I like to
do. I'm not proud of this chapter, but you know what is annoying is whenever you mention it, people are very quick to be like, they're totally fine. They're totally fine. Taylor lip-synced Vampire at the Grammys. And it's like, girls, it's not fine. It's very clearly not fine.
Well, I think especially like with this past Grammys in particular, they're talking to everybody around them, but they're not talking to each other, which I think says more in and of itself. And I don't really blame Olivia for not wanting to talk to her. And I just think that it puts kind of like a weird vibe into the room, and it's like everybody knows it, but nobody's going to mention it. And Sabrina knows it, and Olivia's boyfriend knows it, and everybody who they know knows it. And it's just uncomfortable. And I think it sucks and it bums me out.
And Taylor has all the power because Taylor has all the connections. She has all the friends. Like, everybody has to be nice to Taylor. So I think the only person really that ends up suffering and being uncomfortable is Olivia Rodrigo. And she's mentioned before how uncomfortable she finds award shows. And I have to think that that's in no small part due to the fact that there is like a superstar in the room who you weren't a huge fan of, who has somehow made you feel like you are nothing at some point. And that cannot be a good feeling.
No. It cannot be a good feeling at all. It's a bummer. It is a major class A bummer.
It's a bummer. And let's leave it there.
And let's leave it there. On to another feud with another musician, although this one is going in a radically different direction. I'm talking about Joni Mitchell. We know who this queenie is. Joni Mitchell, who I actually didn't know that she was Canadian. But Joni Mitchell is one of the most influential singer-songwriters of all time, specifically female singer-songwriters of all time. She is a pioneer for women in music and certainly for female singer-songwriters in music. So as such, you can fathom that Taylor was predisposed to be very influenced and inspired by Joni Mitchell. It was in the DNA and the proof was in the pudding. Now, back in the day, Taylor wasn't really instantaneously just being compared to Joni Mitchell. We're talking about post-Speak Now era, pre-Red era, when Taylor was still not necessarily being taken seriously. And I don't think, and I don't remember people back then seeing the similarities between her and Joni, whether or not they were actually there or not, that's up to interpretation. I would say they were, but back then, music critics, not so much. Cue April 2012, when rumors begin circulating of a possible Joni Mitchell biopic with Taylor Swift attached. Now, it's really, really interesting, and I think we talked about this a little bit in our Arm Lyrics episode, to think about Taylor being presented with this opportunity to play Joni Mitchell and how that could have possibly inspired the creation of Red. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out that Red was inspired by Joni Mitchell's Blue. So during this interim period of maybe this picture will be made and maybe I'll be playing Joni Mitchell, Taylor was, we know, again, based on Arm Lyrics from the Speak Now tour, listening to a ton of Joni and really getting inspired by her as she was creating her next album, Red. So the blueprint, mind the pun, of Red is really Joni Mitchell's Blue. So when asked again about the biopic in October, right before Red's release, Taylor said, quote, "That's actually not confirmed. I wish I could say it's confirmed. But the thing about movies that I've learned is I've been reading scripts for 5 years and you just don't know what ones are going to get greenlit and which
the
ones
Lorax.
Aren't. So I can't talk about it unless it's the real thing." Now, this "I've been reading scripts for 5 years" comment is absolutely fascinating to me.
That's insane at that period of time, too. 2008, she was reading her CSI script and going, I'm reading scripts.
Exactly. She wanted a role, honey. She wanted an R-O-L-E role. So meanwhile, as a stark contrast to Taylor's optimism about this project, this is what Joni had to say. Quote, I've never heard Taylor's music. I've seen her. Physically, she looks similarly, small-hipped and high cheekbones. I can see why they cast her. I don't know what her music sounds like, but I do know this. If she's going to sing and play me, good luck, unquote. Now we can only assume, that Joni Mitchell had borne witness to Taylor's performance at the Grammys just a mere year or so earlier. And if I was Joni Mitchell,
is that an unreasonable conclusion draw?
If she's going to sing, good luck. And as if the horse weren't already dead, 2 years after all of these rumors and no movie had come about, Joni showed up just to let us all know that it was her personally who killed the biopic and Taylor's dreams. This is what she said. I squelched that. I said to the producer, all you've got is a girl with high cheekbones. It's just a lot of gossip. You don't have the great scenes. Mitchell also said of the source material, written by Sheila Weller, there's a lot of nonsense about me in books. Assumptions, assumptions, assumptions. But the most interesting part, all you've got is a girl with high cheekbones.
She was for that. You were
Mitchell. She was saying great gowns, beautiful gowns. That lady did not want Taylor playing her. But to be fair, it seems like it wasn't just about Taylor. She seemed to just kind of like not really want a biopic.
I
always
want to
say biopic or biopic, and I can never decide which one it is.
I say biopic.
She didn't want a biopic about her. And honestly, I get it. I completely understand.
I'm sick of people doing biopics on people who are alive. It's like, can we let these people live, please? And also, this was like, what, 15 years ago? Joni Mitchell's still alive. She's still kicking. Like, it's too soon. And also, the Swifties really are deranged about this specific conflict. They call her old hag. They call her no hits. They compare her Billboard charts with Taylor Swift.
No hits.
Meanwhile, the Billboard charts didn't start in earnest until after Joni Mitchell had released much music. But the thing is that, you know, Joni Mitchell probably, when she says, I've never heard her music, in 2012, before Red even came out, that's extremely plausible that she had never heard Taylor's music.
100%.
Taylor was not like a radio presence at that time. She was still in a crossover period. And actually around that time, it was Speak Now. So she didn't have a single hit on the radio because none of those songs really charted. So I'm not surprised that Joni Mitchell said that she had not heard any Taylor Swift music. And you're right, Madeline. If there was one thing she was going to have encountered, the Grammys are a relevant award show. I'm sure she tunes in every year just to see like what's going on. And she saw that performance with Stevie Nicks and said, what the hell is that?
What the hell is that?
Many such cases. And if many you saw it too, and you knew nothing else, and you were a great prolific singer, and someone told you this girl is going to play you, you too would say, good luck.
Good luck. Now, the tea about this feud, they've never interacted. I don't even think they've ever met, honey. But
this
I do
hurt.
Think... When one of your idols who you based an entire era of your career on, one of your idols says, if she's gonna sing good luck and all you've got are high cheekbones, we just have to lick our wounds and carry on.
And she kills your dream of finally having a starring role in a movie.
Exactly.
She lost everything at once.
We put Olivia and Joni back to back in the list because if you think about it, Olivia is to Taylor what Taylor is to Joni. Like, that's the whole thing.
She it's says, like, good luck writing
so
that
you
song
know
you speak
how
of,
it
Olivia.
Feels. So you know how it feels when your idol and your inspiration
turns
shoots
around.
You down like your gum on her shoe. And yet you continue the cycle of violence. It's shocking. But this is, I think, one of the most important feuds because it was so... It's so integral to the Taylor Swift story. And I think if these comments hadn't been made and if this biopic had never been trying to get made and Joni didn't have such a poor introduction to like who Taylor is and like her whole world and this, that, and the other thing, everything would have been different.
Things could be really different. She could have acknowledged her as an error. But Joni actually has a real issue. I read this book about her. She has a real issue with supporting female artists. Like she's a pick me in the sense that she likes to be the only woman that is good at doing what she does.
It's like every pioneering woman is exactly the same.
Well, it's a different time.
It's a different time, period. And
it's like you're going to have Brandi Carlisle as
maybe
your bestie when you could have Taylor Swift.
Taylor is... she's from a different era. She's from a different time.
She's an old-timey woman. difference.
I forgive her.
She's forgiven. she's absolved. Okay, Queenie. Okay. So up next at number five, most consequential feuds of all time, I bring this to you with joy, with relish, with pleasure, Katy Perry. Now, here we have Taylor Swift navigating conflict as the narrator. Often in her personal falling outs, Taylor will tell us what side to be on and directly who is wrong. Taylor Swift versus Katy Perry is one of the most iconic feuds in pop culture history. It happened around the time when social media was becoming more prolific than ever, when Katy's cultural influence was descending and Taylor's star power was ascending. This feud was a very essential part of Taylor Swift's 1989 girl boss rebrand. Ironically, but it was. Something that's interesting about Taylor is how she manages to be the underdog and the wounded party, even when she is the aggressor. In her public story at the time, Taylor was being an independent girl boss on her way to liberation. She moved to New York City. She put out Blank Space. She was being hunted down unfairly by the press for being a man-eater. She met Lena Dunham and became Gloria Steinem. So here she was taking back her power and empowering women all over the world with her girl bossery. All women, of course, except Katy Perry, who, if you take the Bad Blood video literally, deserved to get gang executed by Taylor Swift and all of her real women and real friends. And I think we all need to remember that the person who started this and carried it on publicly was Taylor Swift. She is the aggressor the entire way through this feud, at least in public. Who knows what went on behind closed doors? But she is learning that she can use her star power for evil here. Okay, she started it with Camila Bell, and this was a next level campaign. The Tay Voodoo. We love it when she turns her influence against worthy targets, but it can be hard to watch when she starts punching down. So, of course, it all began with a cover story, a fake news interpretation of what she was really mad about. Taylor tells Rolling Stone that Katy did something so horrible. Quote, "I was like, oh, we're just straight up enemies. It had to do with business. You'd think she was sabotaging her contract or selling her life's work to Scooter Braun. But no, she wanted us to believe that Katy Perry was dead forever because of some replaceable backup dancers. Nice try. Nice try." Katy took some pot shots back at Taylor on Twitter, but she was really at a disadvantage because she was taking a break from music at this time. Like, she wasn't in the public eye. Taylor, of course, is at the height of her powers, and she chooses to strike when Katy's out of the game. Her attempts at clapbacks were, of course, humiliating, far too late, swish, swish, bish, and way after the fact. Though she did absolutely assist Nicki Minaj, as we discussed, in temporarily silencing Taylor. Finding it hard to parade the pit women against each other women as one immeasurably capitalizes on the takedown of another. And she was making a convoluted, indecipherable point. Regina George in sheep's clothing, and where was the lie? I'm not seeing the lie. From Katy Perry's perspective, it's true. So this went on for a very long time. And Taylor eventually manipulated Katy Perry into apologizing to her. Katy Perry had to send Taylor Swift an olive branch. And Taylor definitely milked this personal drama to help promote 1989. And I think of this very differently in hindsight. She wasn't willing to engage in the usual guess which boy this song is about line of intrigue because she was hashtag single, hashtag girl boss at this period of time. She was over that entire line of conversation. So instead, she drummed up intrigue by revealing the title of this song, Bad Blood, in an interview months before the album came out. And directly putting the target on Katy Perry's back. The fact that Taylor also chose to close the loop on this saga with a cameo in a music video is crazy. Like, she is such a narrative performance artist in public, and all of her public conflicts have to have public resolutions, which is a very interesting thing that only famous people, and Taylor Swift specifically, who makes everything as a narrator about her life, has to do. So iconic for many, many reasons.
Iconic for every reason. Now, this is probably the Taylor Swift feud that I think I mean, there's obviously this is only number five. So obviously we think that there are a few more that are a little bit more important than this one or more interesting or more funny. But this is one that will go down in the annals of history, ladies and gentlemen, because it was Taylor punching Katy Perry as Katy Perry's hands were tied behind her back. Katy was on a break from music.
She literally wasn't doing anything.
It's time.
She was lying down and yep. Taylor said, time to
all
strike.
Right, let's go. Yep, time to strike. Hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
Who's up next? Who do we got at number four?
Okay, so number four most iconic feud of Taylor Swift. Nicki Minaj, the barb in charge. So this is a feud that began with friendship, or at least mutual respect. Recall that Nicki has credited Taylor with making Super Bass hot after Taylor went on a radio station and rapped the first verse in an act of humiliation. And then Taylor also brought Nicki out on stage on the Speak Now tour to perform Super Bass with her. For years after that, Nicki never had anything but glowing praise to say about Taylor. She's so cute. She's so great. She made Super Bass hot. I love that girl, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the thing about the barb in charge is that this is a woman you want in your corner, ladies and gentlemen. Yep. So we were cheering and clapping. Yes, Nicki loves Taylor. Taylor loves Nicki. We like to see it. Fast forward to 2016.
2015, by the way.
Oh, 2015. Fast forward to 2015. The tides are beginning to turn. Everyone is beginning to resent the girl squad. They're saying Taylor annoying, Taylor boy crazy, Taylor slut, Taylor skinny, Taylor too many model friends, Taylor everywhere, Taylor annoying.
Taylor skinny, it's true.
Taylor not really a feminist. So already there's sort of a lot of negative energy hanging in the air. And then for some reason, when the tides are beginning to turn, Taylor goes and does the stupidest thing that she could ever possibly do. She decides that she wants to challenge Nicki Minaj publicly on Twitter. Earlier, we already talked about this. Nicki took issue with how black women got overlooked too often in award shows like the Grammys and was making a point completely separate from anything that Taylor needed to stick her nose into. And Taylor, in true white woman form, said, "Is this fucking play about me?" No. Still, she persisted. She said, quote, "I've done nothing but love and support you. It's unlike you to pit women against each other. Maybe one of the men took your slot. If there was a camera in the room, it would have panned to me doing the Beyonce's face at the 2009 VMAs, looking on in horror as she watches but cannot stop what's occurring on stage in her name." I remember I was at work and I got the tweet notification and I was like, this can't be happening. This did not happen.
No, I was immediately terrified.
We were scared. This is wrong. Nicki was so baffled. You can even read it in the tweet. Yeah. She's utterly baffled at the balls. She goes,
"The audacity.
You must not be reading my tweets. I never said a word about you. I love you just as much, but you should speak on this." Oh, that you should
Taylor,
speak on this.
Can you imagine gathered. The meltdowns in Taylor Nation headquarters? Yeah. Can you, Taylor oh. running around screaming?
Oh, it
She's
was
like, my career
crazy.
Is over. Get the life insurance policy out. Got to pull yeah. a parachute.
Now, what I kind of forgot about this moment is that Nicki was online as this was happening. She was sitting there on her phone, kind of a bit like gearing up to do a Bigfoot. She was getting ready to go Bigfoot. When Katy Perry tweeted her bullshit, she sent Katy a kissy emoji. I forgot about this. She also then liked a tweet where one of her fans said that she should pull a Kanye on Taylor.
Oh.
She was mad. And Taylor
had to call her.
Terrified.
Taylor had to pick up the phone yeah. and speak with her to
so
get it
Taylor
to stop.
Frantically Please. Tweets,
call
"You're
phones.
Welcome on any stage I'm on."
Oh my God.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
What are you talking about? She's just assuming she's going to win. She's assuming she's going to win.
So in this interim between Taylor tweeting nonsense and then ultimately apologizing, Nicki tweets, "I'm so glad you guys get to see how this stuff works. Taylor took her music off Spotify and was applauded. We launched Tidal and we were dragged." Okay, now hold on.
Okay,
let's
where did that
this
come
case
from?
Up.
I'd
she
like to hear about that.
She was making points left and right. But luckily, Taylor comes to her senses before Nicki can start saying, they call her 6 foot, Bigfoot, 6 foot. It was about to go there. It was just about to go there. And then Taylor tweets, I thought I was being called out. I missed the point. I misunderstood, then misspoke. I'm sorry, Nikki. Nikki says, that means so much, Taylor. Thank you. And in a final show of solidarity.
She is so lucky.
Yeah, she's literally. In a final show of solidarity, Nikki brought Taylor out on the VMA stage, the source of the drama, and they performed The Night Is Still Young and Bad Blood together. So Crisis
Taylor lip-synced for the very first time by doing
Bad
Blood.
Yeah, and it was amazing. And it was amazing.
Did she look terrified? She looked terrified. And she
was very
be,
scared.
Because she was very nearly over.
Oh, it would have been like that, ladies and gentlemen.
That could have been Snakegate before Snakegate. Yep. Like, that really could have been. And it would have been worse because Nikki knows where the bodies are buried.
Since then, there have been no problems between Taylor and Nikki, probably because Taylor was sitting in that audience that day when Nikki said, back to this bitch who had a lot to say about me the other day in the press, Miley, what's good? And she said, I don't want the smoke.
And that can
you
never
know
be
what?
Me.
The thing is, I think honestly, Nikki doesn't want the smoke either. I think both of them are aware that they have two powerful, very demented fan bases. And I think everyone can agree that it's best for all parties involved if we just
get
along.
That's for the health of the world.
It
if
is.
We
it's
just
best Barbs and Swifties alliance because there's
that's why we're Barbs.
Exactly.
I'm a Barb.
And I've never said anything different. I've
no,
never said
I'm
anything different.
I'm a Barb. Nope. I'm a Barb. I'm a Barb.
Nope.
I'm a Barb. So that's the Barb Nation Summit. Up next at number three in most iconic feuds is one of my personal favorites, Bob Lefsetz. This is one of my favorite feuds because it's so easy to root for Taylor in this one. This was the original underdog origin story. You could even say that she was inspired to do Speak Now, not just Mean, Speak Now, as an entirely self-written album thanks to this man alone. You people underestimate how many links I will go to inconvenience myself, et cetera, to prove a point. Bob Lefsetz is a flop music industry analyst and writer who we regularly chart higher than on the podcast charts. I'd just like to throw that out there, who is, surprise, surprise, a subscriber to the same basic philosophy as Damon Albarn. Rockism. Pop music, bad. Female writers, inept frauds. I know better than everyone else. He is kind of like an industry critic, I guess. Like his critiques are focused more towards people who are in the music industry rather than for like music consumers. So his newsletter, the Lefsetz Letter, was at one point read very widely by people in the biz, including label executives, presumably Scott Borchetta, which is how this landed on Taylor Swift's radar. So his opinion, for some reason, at some point, really mattered to people. So I was like, because he's such a noted flop, I was like, I need to look into this and see, like, did people care about him? Was he actually important and a tastemaker? And the answer is, at a specific moment in time, yes. He was popular with the label executives and the establishment of the industry because he resented the digital age of music. He doesn't like streaming, doesn't like pop music, doesn't like digital downloads. He thinks co-writing is nonsense. And his straw man, the person that he chose to make the effigy of everything wrong with modern music, was Taylor Swift. At the very outset of her career, we're talking from like pretty much debut onwards, he's throwing stones. The incident that really sparked her attention of his criticism and hurt her feelings was him leading the charge of calling her a fraud after her bad performance at the Grammys. He said she can't sing and she's borderline unsophisticated. He went on to say that her success was a flash in the pan and she would never go far due to her horrible singing abilities. Again, can we blame people for saying that after that?
I want to talk about unsophisticated. What the hell
Let's
does that
there.
Mean?
We'll
what
start
does
with that.
That
the
mean?
Singing.
How are you going
to
say
have,
this
we have
gorgeous
the singing alone.
Supermodel
in
her
blue
in her
gown.
Dress and her boots is unsophisticated? What are you talking about? What does
She's
that
singing
mean?
Singing with Stevie Nicks. And what are you doing? And what are you doing?
And who are you, sir?
So Taylor goes on to write Mean about him, which is one of the funniest and most juvenile songs she has ever written. She specifically affects small town country girl for this specific song to emphasize that she's the wounded, innocent little girl with her guitar and her feelings. His response was to say that they were friends. Apparently, he said they were friendly. He was friendly with Scott Borchetta. I didn't know this. He was friendly with Scott Borchetta. He was also friendly with Taylor, and that she started hating him after he critiqued her. Then he went on to stand by what he said after Speak Now had come out. Like, she's nothing. She's not going to go anywhere because she can't sing. What's so crazy is that in the coming years, he's gone on to exalt Fearless as like the best album ever made. He wrote this entire essay about how Tell Me Why is a great masterpiece. He compares it to the Beatles, but only he only says this. This is during 1989. He only says this to go on and say that her pop music is garbage. And now she's a fake. But back then she was real. But now she's really fake. Meanwhile, we have you on tape. We have you on tape saying
no,
fearless,
candid camera.
Fake,
candid
fraud.
Camera.
Taylor candid never camera. Addressed him again, but he kept swinging. He said during her master recording saga, he had one comment only, and his comment was, well, she should have just bought the label. Thanks, genius.
Didn't think of that. Genius.
You and your letter.
Sherlock.
I mean, now that I think about it, it does – this whole saga does set a little bit of a dangerous precedent, which is if you criticize me, I will use my art as a weapon against you. But you can argue that she does that with her exes too. I guess it just depends on whether you feel bad for her victims or not. Generally, I don't.
I mean, there are some, obviously, we've been talking about.
Yeah,
Bob Love says you're nothing, you're over. There are a couple of victims of Taylor's that I do feel bad for. We just talked about it. But when it comes to the men, largely the men, I have nothing but hate in my heart for you. So.
And the remaining people we're going to talk about should all be executed. Should all be to the gallows. Electric chair for all of them. Who's the second most impactful Taylor Swift iconic feud, Madeline?
So we're at the tippity top now. So I would assume that most people could guess who is going to be at the very top. You don't know who's going to be number two, who's going to be number one. We decided that number two most impactful feud of Taylor's career, Kim Kardashian and Kanye West and Snakegate. Where to even begin, ladies and gentlemen? This is the longest. Well, no, that's not true, is it? Is it the longest running feud? I guess you could argue this is the thing where the most things happened. Like the most big, it wasn't just one event and then it's a feud for life. It was thing after thing after thing. It spans years, 10 straight years of back and forth and back and forth. So it, of course, all starts at the 2009 VMAs when Taylor wins the VMA for Female Video of the Year and Kanye takes a microphone out of her hand and says, I'm gonna let you finish, but Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. So this puts their relationship off on the wrong foot pretty much from the get-go. They avoided each other for years. They wrote songs about one another, but neither of those songs were particularly good and kind of nobody cared about either of them. Years go by with them never interacting, never talking. Kanye would occasionally go off on one of his rants at concerts. He used to do that all the time. Par for the course. Nothing happened for years and years with this particular relationship until Jay-Z decides to stick his big hands into the situation and mend their relationship. We owe Snakegate to Jay-Z. I forgot about
Thanks.
This and I've remembered and it's for life. I'm coming for you for the rest of your life, Jay-Z.
I wish
you
that we could not have this
with
moment
cheating
for
on
life.
Beyonce. You had to bring this all back up. You had to exhume the dead body, didn't you, Jay-Z?
That was
so
wrong.
This is what Taylor said. I feel like I wasn't ready to be friends with him until I felt like he had some sort of respect for me. And he wasn't ready to be friends with me until he had some sort of respect for me. So it was the same issue. And we both reached the same place at the same time. I became friends with Jay-Z. And I think it was important for Jay-Z, for Kanye, and I to get along. It started with both of us really liking Jay and wanting him to be happy. And then Kanye and
what?
I both reached a place where he would say really nice things about my music and what I've accomplished. And I could ask him how his kid's doing. But hey, I like Kanye as a person, and that's a really good, nice first step, a nice place for us to be. She added about Kim Kardashian, who was his wife at the time, I love Kim. She's the sweetest. She's just a really sweet, kind, warm person. Is she?
Is she?
Is
Would
she?
You say that again today?
They encounter each other at the Grammys that year, the 2015 Grammys, when she's in one of my favorites, the ombre blue gown. I love that gown. And they take pictures together and everyone's saying, yeah, Kanye and Taylor friends again. We couldn't have even imagined how terrible would go on to become.
We should have known.
I don't know what we were thinking. I don't know what we were
they
thinking.
Were both
I
also
genuinely
in
don't.
Some of the most messy boots periods of their careers when they decided to reconcile.
Oh, yes. So later on in that same year, Taylor presents Kanye West with the Video Vanguard Life Achievement Award on the VMAs, which
looking
was very full circle, of course. Yeah, looking like a literal clown, like a rodeo clown. Foolish outfit, foolish makeup, foolish hair slicked back, just clownish.
Everything about it.
We should have known. We should have known then and there. Because, you know, this is very full circle, because the VMAs is where all the bad stuff happened. And now it will be the place where the reconciliation officially, publicly occurs. Just like we're talking about. It's all a narrative, baby. It's all in the narrative. So in this speech, the only thing I remember about it is that Kanye says he's going to run for president. Well, let's that aged well. So the next day after this happens, Kanye sends Taylor a big thing of flowers. And she posted on Instagram saying, thank you. Well, everything looks good to me. Fast forward to January 2016.
Womp womp.
Kanye West holds a listening party at Madison Square Garden for his brand new album at the time, Life of Pablo. And that record contained the song Famous. Word started spreading very fast that there was a lyric that explicitly references Taylor. There was also a blurry video of Karlie Kloss being there physically, and it was being posted and passed around. And as this lyric was being said, I made that bitch famous, et cetera, et cetera. She looked like she couldn't have cared less as she heard I made that bitch famous. And I remember everyone was saying, she looks so disgusted. She looks like she can't believe it. And I'm like, she doesn't look like anything.
She DGAF.
She literally DGAF.
I also feel like, can we just for a moment say that the lyric that was included, it's like, I understand why Taylor chose to take issue with it, but I do think she kind of took it out of context a little bit. Like, I don't think it's the worst thing. What he did with the music video is a separate thing, a separate issue. But I think what he said about her was kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of just the way that he raps and the way that he like hosts and the way that he intonates. And I don't think he actually meant verbatim what he said either. It was like a larger thing, but I just wanted to throw that out there. That's my two cents.
So after this happens, the news breaks that same day via T-Pain, of course, that Taylor never knew specifically about the that bitch line. And also, this is the very first thing that was ever said about this entire situation from Taylor's camp. They claimed that Taylor cautioned Kanye about releasing a song with a strong misogynistic message. That's something that I guarantee you did not happen. Taylor never cautioned anybody, let alone Kanye West, about releasing a song with a strong misogynistic message. So you're saying that you didn't know about that bitch line at the same time that you did know about it, and you're saying it was misogynistic. But you couldn't have known it was misogynistic because you didn't know about that bitch line. So which one is it? This is like the root of this exact quote from T-Pain
is the
entire issue.
And this is why we say we're astounded that T-Pain kept her job.
Right, because this was mishandled at the source, and the source was T-Pain. So After Taylor, you know, Taylor's camp, I should say, sends out this note
about
admonishment about it. We have people burning their Yeezys, taking their Yeezys off an Instagram post. It's becoming a big thing immediately because Kanye insisted that she knew, and not just that she knew, but that she was in full support of it. So fast forward a couple of weeks later, on February 15th, 2016, the Grammys take place. Famously, Taylor won the Grammy that night for Album of the Year for 1989. Oh God, that was all you wanted.
Yeah,
and she makes a speech that seems to pretty directly reference what's going on with Kanye at the time. Quote, as the first woman to win Album of the Year at the Grammys twice, I want to say to all the young women out there, there are going to be people along the way who will try to undercut your success or take credit for your accomplishments or your fame. But if you just focus on the work and you don't let those people sidetrack you, someday when you get where you're going, you will know it was you and the people who love you who put you there. And that will be the greatest feeling in the world, unquote. Were you focusing on the work? I'm asking you.
Were you?
Were you focusing on the
Tori
work?
Tori Kelly
no,
stank face.
You were... up to your knees in the shit pile already. Mm-hmm. You were not focusing on the work. You
were. There was no work.
No, you were focusing on the mess. You were focusing on the mess. So in the following weeks, tons of random industry insiders, people like Grammy voters, random D-list celebrities would come out of the woodwork and claim that they somehow knew that Taylor 100% was aware about the that bitch line in Famous, and Taylor is starting to lose credibility as a liar and somebody who wants to be a victim very fast. To make matters ultimately worse, Kim Kardashian starts stepping in and insisting also that Taylor knew about this and that she just wants to play the victim. So Kim says on Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Kim is standing by her husband. Taylor is dragging Kanye through the mud. Kim claims that Taylor said she was going to go to the Grammys red carpet and say that she was in on this whole thing and it was all publicity stunt, this, that, and the other thing. And Chloe says Taylor prefers to be thought of as a victim. So the narrative of Taylor being a perpetual victim was an important one in this specific instance to spin because it's what people already thought about her anyway.
It was smart.
So for it was smart.
Spin doctor.
And it worked. And it was a spin doctor at work. For a while, it was just Kanye and Kim's word against Taylor's, as public sentiment for Taylor is still turning negative. And then, to make everything come to the pinnacle, Kim posts on Snapchat the leaked and edited phone call. In the edited call, it appears like Taylor does give her blessing to Famous and is in full support of it. And then after this, Taylor posts a note. And this, I still can't believe it. Looking at it today, I was in awe of how stupid it is. It's a tweet, and it says, that
notes
moment
app apology.
When Kanye secretly records your phone call, and then Kim posts it on the internet. And it's a notes app. It's a notes app apology.
So millennial. That
and
moment
it says,
when.
It's just like, Taylor, you are in deep, deep trouble, and you're doing memes. Okay.
Yep.
So it says, yes, there's the video of Kanye telling me he was going to call me. That bitch in his song. It doesn't exist because it never happened. Another thing she says, he promised to play the song for me, but he never did. You cannot approve a song you've never heard. I would very much like to be excluded from this narrative, one that I've never asked to be a part of since 2009. Now,
iconic.
Something that I think there's multiple things she says that are so true. You cannot approve a song that you've never heard. You can't.
Tea.
It just can't
say
be
that.
Done. And it's T. Say it. So nobody believes her. Nobody believes her when she claims that it's edited and it doesn't show the full story. Snakegate occurs. Taylor Swift is over party happens. It was a very not fun time to be Taylor. I'll tell you that for free. And everybody remembers this. To add insult to injury, the Famous video comes out. It's clearly the revenge porn and it shows a wax model of Taylor.
Evil.
Totally naked in bed with various other
Evil.
Celebrities. Also naked. And nobody seemed to think that this was a problem because it was Taylor Swift and, well, Taylor Swift was over. Any other person on the face of the planet this could have happened to, it would have been...
Well, people were saying Amber Rose. They were defending Amber Rose because Amber Rose was upset about this too, rightfully so. She was also depicted in the nude and people were writing for her. But for Taylor, for a while after this, it was like... Not only – it was like the swing in the opposite direction. It was like, okay, feminism is only not about you anymore. You're exempt from it. Like remember when she was on the Time magazine cover for
right.
the sexual
yeah.
assault trial and everybody was like, you don't deserve to be there.
Yeah. Many such cases. So that just to give you an idea, if you weren't there, that's how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
We can't even get – revenge porn is okay as long as it happens to Taylor Swift. That's
Your sexual assault wasn't that
saying.
Bad. I mean,
yeah.
come on
Et cetera,
now.
Et cetera. So – After that, we get Reputation. She maintains her innocence. They tried to cancel her. She rose up from the dead, et cetera, et cetera. It isn't until 2020 that the unedited phone call leaks and proves that Taylor was telling the truth. And nobody cared, to be
nobody
fair.
Nobody cared.
2020 was a time. Specifically, March 2020 was a time. But still, no
we had other things
nobody
to do.
Cared. When it's burn the bitch, they're shrieking. When the truth comes out, it's quiet. I think we should talk about it. But whether they were quiet or not, this sets the scene really for Folklore to be released and for everyone to decide they like Taylor Swift again. And additionally, at the same time, Kanye West is descending into madness and Nazism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every now and then, he still does like to bring up Taylor. He went to the Grammys. I feel like he specifically went to the Grammys this year to try to talk to her, among other things. He unfollowed everyone else on Instagram except for Taylor. He's constantly begging for her attention. It's harassment from an unwell individual. It's not funny. People always act like, haha, it's so funny. It's not funny. He's not
no,
right in the head.
It stopped
and this
being
is harassment.
Funny when he started becoming very obviously mentally ill and dangerous. So if I was Taylor, I also would not feel comfortable about that. Luckily, he's not getting within 100 feet of her. That's never happening.
It's never going to happen. He was removed. They said,
yep.
You can't be here, man. What are
Ejected
you doing?
Ejected from, not
Ejected.
Invited.
Not invited.
Not invited. So iconic and prolific for many, many reasons, but not as iconic and prolific as our number one most inspired feud, I suppose we can call it. And that's because Queen is 100% right. She's never done anything wrong in her life. Every single thing about this scenario, I'm with her. Hashtag, I'm with her.
Mm-hmm. Hashtag, I'm
so,
with her.
So... We got to stop the steal. It's Scott Borchetta and Scooter Braun. By far and away, the most consequential feud of her career and one of the most important things that has ever happened to her in her professional life, personal drama of it all aside. This spurred her to reclaim ownership of her own work by upending the music industry's contract system, copycatting her original works because she owned the publishing, and using her art to settle a score in the most dramatic, public, and fatal way. So here is a refresher for the uninitiated. Scott Borchetta, Demon, was the CEO of Big Machine Label Group, the record label that signed Taylor when she was 15. She remained with Big Machine for 13 years, during which she released her first six studio albums. You know what they are. However, Scott Borchetta sold the label and with it the master recordings of all of these albums to Scooter Braun and Ithaca Holdings in 2019. So Taylor says pretty much immediately as after this deal becomes clear, it seems like they're fine, actually, because remember on the Reputation tour and during the Reputation era, like they had, Scott and Taylor had like nice words to say about each other and nice words to say about them moving on. Like when she signed her deal with Universal, Scott commented like they had an exchange where Taylor was like, I'm grateful to Scott and everything we went through. So clearly she wasn't aware of what was about to transpire. So Taylor alleged that she was not given the opportunity to buy her masters back. She was given a bad deal in which if she turned in a new album, she would get to own all her old albums one at a time. That's six more albums with a label that's clearly like not valuing her at all. And she had creative differences with, as we would come to learn. So she was not given the opportunity to buy her masters back and was blindsided by who it was sold to. She knew it was going to be sold, but she didn't know who to. She accused Scooter Braun of being a bully, citing his past affiliation with Kanye West and Justin Bieber, both of whom had mocked her publicly. She also claimed that both Scooter Braun and Scott Borchetta deliberately kept her in the dark about the sale. One of the most harrowing things from this period of time is that disgusting image of the two of them in that dark room with like basically cigars and whiskey cheersing to each other while Taylor is like publicly spinning out about how devastated she is that she's lost control of her life's work. That.
They're never seeing heaven. They're never going to see sick. The pearly white gates. You will be in hell and I will see the harvest.
And you know what? This is really just proving the arrogance of men, because if you really thought, a lot of legal industry experts have come out and said, Scooter Braun is a bad businessman, because if you're going to make an investment like that, if you're going to make a purchase that big, you need to do your due diligence on who's selling the purchase. And like one of the first things that you should do is check that the artist is amiable to what you want to do with their catalog of work. If they're not, and they own the publishing, they can make your life really difficult. So there was no reason for Scooter to do this secretly if he didn't know that Taylor would have a problem with it. Like, why the secrecy if there's no issue, right? So on June 30th, she wrote a Tumblr post detailing how hurt she was by the sale. She says, Scooter has stripped me of my life's work and I wasn't given an opportunity to buy it back. He immediately responds and claims that Taylor had every chance to negotiate, but she refused. Taylor says that she would re-record her first six albums to reclaim ownership of her work, which of course led to the Taylor's Version project. And in 2020, Scooter Braun sold Taylor's masters to Shamrock Holdings, a private equity firm, for a reported $300 million. Now, he has characterized this as like righting all the wrongs, but Taylor made a post and talked about the fine tune of the details. She said that she was given the opportunity to buy them back from Scooter and Ithaca, but only if she would sign an NDA saying that she would never disparage Scooter Braun publicly ever again. And she wasn't willing to do that.
She said absolutely not.
She was like,
I didn't
my work is
have
important
it in
to
myself
me.
To go with Grace, baby.
No.
Not this
said,
time.
My work is important to me, but never being able to say that you're the worst person in the world again is way more important to me. That is more important.
We needed the songs. We needed
as
the songs.
As it should be. As
imagine
it
a world
should be.
Where we don't have karma. Imagine that world.
Yeah, imagine a world imagine where it. She just bought the masters back and then nothing happened. I mean, nope. No. And also the deal point was that Scooter continues to profit off of the use of her master recordings. Like in the deal memo somewhere, he's still getting a kickback. And she was like, that wasn't agreeable to me. Fair enough, queen. And Shamrock Holdings allegedly were very upset by the time that they ended up buying these because they thought that once Taylor knew that Scooter wasn't involved, she would be cooperative with them. And Taylor read the fine print and said, no, I'm not going to cooperate
they thought they
with
had
you,
her.
Actually.
Mm-mm.
They didn't.
Not on my watch.
So how to devalue your investment? It's widely speculated that Scooter actually lost money on this deal, which I hope is true. I hope that that is true. So what was the impact of this feud? Well, Taylor's re-recording strategy was wildly successful and Scooter Braun's career tanked. Like it's actually amazing what happened to him. And, you know, he didn't even try to mitigate this because he was so arrogant and confident that he could spin this. Like for a while after the, you know, Lover came out, it didn't do as well as people were expecting it to do. Taylor was kind of, it seemed slipping a little bit and not being such a powerful force. And Scooter Braun had Ariana Grande and Justin Bieber, who at this time were like some of the biggest artists in the world. So it seemed for a moment that he was going to win. And I think that he was lazy. He thought, yeah, I'm going to win. I'm going to get all my clients to speak on my behalf. And he kept saying in public as well, like lying about it and saying, you know, like I gave her every opportunity. I'm the bigger person. I've given her the chance to come to the table and negotiate. And it's like, she doesn't want to negotiate. She said from the beginning, she doesn't like you. There's no scenario in which you own her work and she is happy about it. And you knew that. So why would she negotiate with you? Very recently, you know, he has been dropped by all of his clients. He has to have his comments turned off forever on his Instagram. He has no career. He has no life. And he eventually
you see how that works.
Came out and said, eventually, after all of this, blaming Taylor, gaslighting her, he eventually came out and said, I probably shouldn't have done that. It's too late for that.
And it's delicious. And it makes it, and he lost his wife, can't see the kids. I don't know that, but I do know he lost his wife.
2023 and 2024 must have been really annoying years to be Scooter Braun, because Taylor was everywhere and you were making $0 off her back catalog.
Yum, yum, yum.
Oh, it's delicious.
For the hell of it. Addicted to
period.
Chair,
and you know what?
It.
Scott Borchetta gets off way too easy with this. Like, I think we blame Scooter a lot, but like Scott is the real evil person because she looked at him as a father figure. She trusted him. She respected him. She grew into a creative person under his eye, kind of. And for him to turn around and manipulate her like he was nothing, because he said bad things about her too when this happened. He was like, she had every opportunity. I'm pretty sure he leaned into the, Taylor, this is just not true. You're playing the victim as always. Like, that must have really hurt. Really, really hurt. And the way that she handled this, it's a convergence of all the types of conflict. She's the narrator. She's controlling the story. We don't really know the details of why she hates Scooter Braun so much, but we trust her emotional response. I do. The businesswoman, she's saying, okay, if I can't get my way emotionally, I'm going to make this so that you rue the day. And also the underdog, me versus these hugely powerful men.
And it
wins.
Do you
see how that works?
Do you see how that works? She's a woman with many feuds, ladies and gentlemen, and yet she's still right every time, even when she's wrong.
Even when she's wrong,
she's right. Even when she's wrong, she's
right. She's never done anything wrong a day in her life, and that's what you should know.
Period.
From Evolution of a Snake podcast. Well, you should really go to evolutionofasnake.com and get tickets to see Evolution of a Snake live.
It could be yours. It could be yours.
Not for long. It's like 80 days till our first show, and we're ready. We're not, but we're ready. You see how that works?
You see All how right. that works.
Goodbye, Snake Nation.